Hey, listeners, thanks for dropping in. I'm Christy.
And I'm Melissa, and this is Buried Motives, where we dig deep into the details of some of the most gruesome
dirtbag murderers. Hey, listeners.
Welcome back to Buried Motives.
Thank you for joining us.
We are happy that you're taking some time out of your busy week to hang out with us and listen to our cases.
We really are. We do appreciate it. If you haven't liked or subscribed wherever you're listening, we would appreciate you doing so. And if you do, maybe the Easter Bunny will be good to you this year.
Hopefully he's good to you either way, because we do wish you a happy Easter.
We do. I hope you get a lot of chocolate and have a wonderful time with your families or whoever you choose to spend the holiday with.
Personally, I'm hoping for a lot of chocolate. That is our favorite snack in the snack pantry.
You and me both, girl.
But there really aren't very many that we turn down from there.
No. If I'm being honest, I might prefer potato chips over chocolate even, but they're too loud and crunchy to have when you're recording.
Yeah.
Now that I say that, I'm conflicted. I can have two loves.
She's a fence sitter. At least when it comes to snacks.
No, I just don't discriminate.
Oh, that's right.
I love them all. But because Easter is approaching, I'm assuming you have an Easter-related case?
I do. This case happened on Easter.
It's almost shocking to me that something like a murder can take place on a religious holiday. It seems like the opposite of what should be happening.
And in this case, you might find that especially true. And we'll even dabble a little bit into some resurrection today.
Resurrection?
Yes. Because this dirtbag secrets were covered up by a lot of people, and it took a long time for that truth to be resurrected.
Oh, I thought we were going cult-like. They're trying to resurrect the dead. I went literal resurrection.
No.
I was like, what? We are? I don't think I've heard this case.
That would be a really different direction. But in this case, the dirtbag was able to get away with murder for years, and the victim's family was made to live in the pain of losing their loved one continually, never having closure because somebody chose to cover it up. Today, we're going to talk about a dirtbag that got away with his evil actions for 57
years. 57 years?
Mm-hmm.
And so we actually have two dirtbags, him and the person that helped cover it up.
Well, I'll leave that for you to decide. Because this dirtbag's actions weren't a secret.
Is this another open secret?
A very open secret.
Oh, man.
The dirtbag was John Bernard Feit. On February 9th, 2016, police escorted his frail 83-year-old frame into the holding room at the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office in Phoenix. But it wasn't the Phoenix police officers that had questions for this white-haired grandfather. It was two Texas Rangers that were accusing him of murder in Hidalgo County, Texas, committed in 1960.
Can you imagine all of a sudden your old grandpa, who's in his 80s, gets arrested for murder?
It was quite shocking, but these two Texas Rangers had come to see that justice was done, and they didn't care how long it had been.
Oh, absolutely not.
No. But you are perfectly correct in assuming that it was a surprise. John's friends and family in Scottsdale, Arizona were shocked that anyone could accuse this sweet old man of the vile things that they were accusing him of. John was retired and living a comfortable life with his wife, Mary Lou. They had three grown children, two girls and a boy, and they had been blessed with numerous grandchildren. In the community, he was well regarded as a compassionate person who worked with many charities and was always advocating for those he considered less fortunate than himself.
What?
Hmm?
He seems like the most unlikely suspect.
He really did. That the police actually thought John was a murderer was considered unreasonable by those that knew him. John took their accusations in stride. They didn't actually upset him too much. He told a reporter at the time that he had been questioned about the murder numerous times since the 60s. And so while he was disappointed that they were yet again asking him questions about it, he wasn't exactly surprised. He calmly but vehemently denied having anything to do with it. He seemed to keep his cool despite the hot seat that he found himself sitting in. Probably because this dirtbag had managed to keep the truth hidden for over half a century.
That is so wild.
Hmm?
And that means that for over five decades, he lived with knowing what he did.
Absolutely. For 5 decades, his victims' families lived in turmoil, knowing that justice had never been served.
Ugh.
And he knew it too. That whole time, John Bernard Veit lived a life of ease and comfort and pretended to be a saint, but he was far from it.
I hate him already. Do you think he had actually changed his ways, like became a better person? Do you think he made an effort to do better and be better because of what happened? Like, do you think he had remorse? I obviously know nothing about the case yet, but I'm just curious because you said everyone was so shocked. He was such a good person.
It almost did seem like the latter part of his life was spent trying to make up for the things that he had done when he was younger. But then I say that with a cautionary tone because he really is unremorseful during the trial.
And he's obviously not sorry enough to come forward with the truth.
Exactly.
He's letting another family suffer just so he can enjoy his own life.
Right. And I'm not sure if his years of charitable service were just, hey, look at me. I'm trying to be a nice guy. I'm perfecting a persona that he had created. Or if it actually was repentant. But I'll let you decide.
Okay.
Wait till you hear more of the history.
Okay. I'm super curious.
I think this is another case that will get you riled.
Oh, man. Who, me?
Yes, you.
Couldn't be.
Then who? In the 1960s, the Rio Grande Valley was a heavily Hispanic border town. It was an area that had a small but a fairly strong following of devout Catholics. On April 16, 1960, Holy Saturday, 25-year-old Irene Garza went by herself to the Sacred Heart Church in McAllen, Texas. Irene was on her way to church to participate in confession, something she did every Saturday night. But this Saturday, being Holy Saturday, was extra special. Holy Saturday is a significant day in the Catholic religion. Maybe not as significant as the days that flank it on either side, Good Friday or Easter Sunday, but it does carry its own significance for quiet reflection, as the final day of Lent, and it also begins the Easter Vigil. Irene, as a practicing Catholic, gained solace from confession, and her family would joke that Irene was always attending confession, whether she needed to or not. It was just who she was. In April of 1960, Irene had written to a friend about how important confession had become in her life. She wrote, quote, "I've been going to communion and mass daily, and you can't imagine the courage and faith and happiness it has given me." Irene was a gorgeous woman inside and out. She was the Miss All South Texas sweetheart in 1958, something that was pretty unheard of for a Mexican-American at the time.
Oh.
She and her sister were also the first Mexican-American twirlers in the history of McAllen High School. Irene also held that distinction as the drum majorette as well. In 1960, Irene was working as an elementary school teacher and was well known for her generosity and her soft, elegant manner. Irene was the first in her family to go to college and graduate school.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah, she was just gorgeous inside and out. As a teacher, she displayed her generosity and the love for her students by using her own salary to buy them school supplies and other things the children needed. The school that she taught at serviced the most underprivileged children in McAllen. Her generous nature was something that had endeared her to a lot of people, especially her younger cousins. That Easter, they were eagerly awaiting the Easter baskets that Irene had lovingly teased them about.
Aww.
They were sure that she had gotten them one because Irene was always sharing and giving them little treats.
That's so cute.
It is very cute. But Irene never made it to the family Easter celebration. She wasn't seen again after borrowing her family's car and driving off to confession on Holy Saturday.
Goodness.
The afternoon had rolled into the evening, and the evening had turned into night, and then the next morning. During the investigation into her disappearance, police learned that several people had seen Irene at church. Because of the special holiday, there were a lot of people there that Saturday. And Irene was a beautiful young woman, the kind that always got noticed. It was rumored that some young men had even picked up on Irene's weekly routine of confession and would go to the church just to look at her.
Oh, what a missionary. Yeah. That's amazing.
That's just how beautiful she was, though. She's drop-dead gorgeous.
That says something. When you are beautiful enough to make the boys come to church, you know you have it going on.
Exactly. Hers was a face that many would not forget.
And it seems like she just had the beautiful personality to go with it.
It does. It sounds like she just emanated that countenance that people wanted to be around. From people that had attended the Sacred Heart Church that night, police learned that Irene had been seen waiting in the confession line. She had readied herself by placing her white veil over her head and then stood there patiently waiting her turn. But that's where people's recollection of Irene seemed to vanish. Almost everyone could not recall Irene ever leaving church that night. The next morning, her family's car was found parked down the street from the church, but there were no clues as to where Irene had disappeared to. As the family's angst over what could have happened to their beautiful daughter grew, they tried not to think the worst. That got a lot more difficult when 2 days later, one of Irene's high-heeled shoes was found lying all by itself on the side of the road, a ways from the church.
Well, that's always so creepy.
It is. I don't understand why seeing a single shoe on the roadside always makes me so uneasy, but it just does.
It does me too, because that's totally an interruption when your shoe goes missing. That's not a natural thing. It's not, oh, a hat or a scarf that blew off or you lost an earring. You're going to know if you don't have a shoe, and you're not going to get rid of one shoe willingly.
Right. A single shoe is just so unnerving.
It is.
Just a short distance from that shoe was Irene's patent leather purse and a piece of her white lace veil that people had last seen her in.
A piece of it?
Yeah. The county sheriff's posse fanned out on horseback to comb this expanded search area, many refusing to actually sleep in their effort to find Irene. Sylvia, one of Irene's cousins, was very torn up about her disappearance because the day that Irene had disappeared, Irene had called Sylvia and asked her to come to confession with her. Unfortunately, she had not been home that day. Sylvia would be tormented for years and chewed up with guilt, thinking if only she had been there to accompany her.
That is sad because she is not in fault at all, but I can see how that would eat you up inside. There'd be so many what ifs.
Right. Sylvia said that Irene had expressed concern about going to confession and she just wanted somebody else to accompany her.
Oh, so she was feeling uneasy about it.
Yes. Family and police were all wrought with concern over Irene's disappearance. 5 days after she went missing, police did find her. On Friday, April 21st, Irene was found floating in an irrigation canal. When they dragged her body from the water, Irene originally looked like she was fully dressed, except for her shoes. But as she was examined in more detail, her blouse was found to be partially unbuttoned and her underwear were missing.
Oh no.
Bruising on the insides of her thighs led police to think that she had been sexually assaulted. An autopsy revealed that Irene had been hit with a blunt object and then suffocated.
Melissa, that's a terrible death.
It sounded awful. The coroner also confirmed that Irene had been raped, and there was evidence the violation had actually occurred while she was unconscious.
Really? But at the same time, I'm glad that she wasn't lucid for that.
No, that would have just added so much more fear for her. I can't imagine how traumatic it would be to have your child murdered, but to learn that they had also been assaulted would just add another level.
Oh, it would. It's such a violation.
Mm-hmm. And it would increase the amount of anger that you held towards the person that did it.
Oh, 100% it would.
Because it was 1960, forensics investigation was not what it was today. Investigators didn't have an eyewitness account, and no fingerprints were found anywhere to give them a clue as to what had happened to Irene and who was responsible. The only evidence at the scene that they could find was an imprint of Irene's petticoat on the banks of the canal and a partial heel print from a man's shoe. In an effort to find something that would lead them to the killer, they had the whole irrigation canal drained.
Wow. Good. Because that's not a lot to go off of.
No, it's not a lot to go off of at all. So they drained the whole canal where her body was found. And it was smart thinking on their part. Once the canal was drained, they were able to find a green Kodiak slide viewer with a long black cord just feet from where Irene's body had been found.
Okay, just the viewer, no slides?
Yep, just the viewer, no slides. But the slide viewer looked like it was brand new. And it seemed very odd that it would be found in an irrigation canal. Police didn't believe that it was a coincidence that it was found so close to her body. And so they started to speculate on why it would have been there.
And because it looked brand new, it obviously hadn't been down there for very long.
Right. So some of the police believed that the long black cord could have been used to tie Irene's hands. And some others surmised that because it was such a heavy piece of equipment, that perhaps it was tied around her body to make the body sink. Had that been the case, the murderer had underestimated the buoyancy force. And the handheld slide viewer, while heavy enough at first, had not been enough to keep Irene's body on the canal floor.
How heavy was that if it's handheld?
It must have been pretty heavy to initially hold it down.
Oh, that is surprising. Because that's more than, to me, what you would hold in your hand to watch a few slides.
It didn't look very big from the evidence photos.
Okay.
But that was one of the kind of theories. They were just grasping at straws, trying to figure out why this slide viewer would be found next to Irene's body.
That makes sense. But yeah, to me, it's like probably the weight of a brick. And one brick, I don't think it's going to hold you under.
Not at all.
But I can see how they're just trying to piece this together.
Mm-hmm. The other possibility that they kind of threw around was that perhaps the killer had tied Irene up in haste and the knot had come undone. And so that's how the slide viewer had been separated from the body.
That sounds more plausible to me.
Yeah. There was a lot of speculation around this green slide viewer. Whatever had been its role in Irene's death, the police were sure that it was something that could lead them to the murderer, though. To find out where the slide viewer had come from, the police made a public inquiry asking if anybody recognized it and knew anything about this green slide viewer. So they put it in the paper.
Yeah, I would too.
Mm-hmm. And I don't really know how productive they thought this would be. It wasn't likely that the murderer was going to walk right up and say, oh, yeah, by the way, that is mine.
I don't think the murderer would, but maybe someone would be like, hey, my uncle has that or my brother has that.
Right. The police thought it was worth a shot.
But then again, who doesn't have one, maybe? Mm-hmm. I don't know how common it was.
It wasn't fairly common.
Okay.
Much to the police's shock and mine, that is exactly what this dirtbag did.
What?
Yes. My jaw actually dropped when I read this.
Yeah, that's not something that you would suspect.
No. On April 29, 1960, John wrote the police a letter to claim the projector as his own, and he even gave them details about purchasing it in Port Isabel, Texas, the previous July, at Freddy's Professional Pharmacy for cash, although he couldn't remember exactly how much he paid for it. The police were even more shocked to learn that John was claiming the slide viewer because he was already on their list of suspects as one of the last people to have been seen with Irene.
Oh, man. They must have been jumping up and down saying jackpot.
Yeah. But it just seemed like such an unusual thing to do.
I could see maybe it being, well, if I come forward, then I look like I'm telling the truth. I'm establishing some credit with the police if he thinks they might get back to him anyways.
Maybe that's what he was thinking. But I have a feeling he was just super overconfident that he wouldn't get in trouble.
But you would think usually the dirtbag would do the exact opposite. You're not going to claim anything that's even going to put you a mile's radius close to that body.
Well, this was an expensive piece of audiovisual equipment in the day, Christy.
Did he want it back?
He wanted it back.
No.
Yes.
No. Okay, scratch what I just said. He's just a dirtbag.
Yeah. And I really think that he just thought he wouldn't be punished for this. He thought he was higher than the law. And we'll get into why I think that. John Bernard Feight was born in Chicago on November 24th, 1932. He was the youngest of three children raised in a traditional German Catholic household of Matthias Feight and Mary Susan. John grew up with his older brother Matthias and his older sister Marianne. Both were several years his senior. The family was middle class and lived on the city's south side. At the age of 13, John was sent to an all-boys school in San Antonio. From there, he went on to attend an all-male college and studied at the Oblate of Mary Immaculate before becoming ordained as a Catholic priest on September 8, 1958.
He was the priest?
Yes.
That she was going to confession to?
Yes.
That's a double betrayal.
It's such a betrayal. But that's not the end of the betrayal in this case.
The last person you should be worried about raping and murdering you is your priest.
Yeah. Just like his older brother 2 years before him, he had took a vow of celibacy.
Oh, no, he didn't.
Well, he took the vow. Didn't mean he lived up to it. In the late 1950s, there was a shortage of priests in the Rio Grande Valley. So John was transferred there to begin a year of pastoral training. Father John Feight was 27 at the time. And in 1960, he was the visiting priest at the Sacred Heart Church. He had been sent to the Missional Oblates of Mary Immaculate to provide extra help to the church in McAllen during this busy time of year, and he had been the one to take Irene's confession. While police continued to question hundreds of people, they were pretty confident that Father Feight was somehow involved, especially now that he had connected himself to the slide viewer.
Yeah, he's put himself at the crime scene.
Mm-hmm. Police repeatedly questioned John about his dealings that day and his interactions with Irene. It was no secret to John that he was a suspect in this murder case. After giving several versions of events, John admitted to the police that he had taken Irene to the rectory next to the church to hear her confession face to face. This set off huge warning flags. Giving a confession face-to-face was not something that was normally done and was completely odd for a busy day like Holy Saturday when people were lined up to take their turn in the confessional.
Yeah, so he's taking her outside of that area to get her alone.
Mm-hmm. But he freely admits this. Police learn that John had been seen frequently leaving the church that day and traveling back and forth to his pastoral residence a short distance away. Up to 6 times in 24 hours following Irene's attendance at church, John had traveled back and forth. Again, a very unusual thing during this really busy day.
Oh my goodness.
John tried to say that he had left the church several times that day for various reasons. One of the excuses was to change his clothes. Another excuse was to collect a new pair of glasses. He had all of these bizarre excuses that he told police.
You just say you have diarrhea and you didn't want to use the bathroom there. That's what I would have said.
That's Christie's alibi, guys.
I had the runs.
Well, he was running back and forth a lot.
Oh.
One of the bizarre excuses he told police was that he had a habit of taking off his glasses and fiddling with them while he was hearing confessions. That day, he had fiddled too hard and he had broke his glasses. He had taken a break from hearing confessions to drive 5 miles back to his pastoral house to get another pair. When police learned from another priest, Father Joseph O'Brien, that he had noticed scratches on John's hand that ran vertically down his hands, They questioned him about that. He elaborated on the previous story and told police that when he reached the residence to collect his new pair of glasses, he realized he had forgotten his key. He then had to scale his way to the second floor in order to find a way into the home to get new glasses. While he was scaling the wall, he told them, that's when he had scratched the back of his hands.
Oh, and did he say he drove there or walked? Because if it's 5 miles, I'm assuming he drove. So he had his car keys.
Yeah.
But didn't have the house key.
That's right.
And everybody has those on 2 separate keychains.
Exactly, Christy. It makes complete sense. Like you, police did not believe his story at all.
No.
But they didn't feel like they had enough proof to arrest him. They were very mindful that it was going to be a very delicate situation to accuse a priest of murder.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. One of the investigators at the time would later say that, quote, it was almost a sacrilegious thought to have that a priest could be capable of something like this. But that didn't mean that these dedicated men were just going to give up. They dug into John's past and looked for similar attacks on women, particularly ones that involved priests and churches.
Well, unfortunately, this type of thing does happen in any religion.
Yeah. In anything that gives somebody a position of power, it seems.
Yes.
It can be abused. They didn't have to go far. Just 23 days before Irene's disappearance, Maria America Garaw had gone into the Sacred Heart Church in Edinburgh, which was a neighboring town to McAllen. While Maria was walking into the church, she noticed a man watching her from a blue and white car. She didn't think too much about him as she crossed into the church. She was also a beautiful woman. And again, I don't think it would have been too uncommon for her to have men watching her. So it didn't really make her that uneasy, but she did notice him.
And I'm assuming she's Mexican as well.
Yes. John definitely had a type.
Okay.
As she was kneeling at the communion rail, the same man that she had seen outside approached her from behind, grabbed her, and tried to put a rag over her mouth.
Oh.
When the man threw her to the ground, Maria fought her assailant, biting his finger so hard that she could taste his blood in her mouth.
Oh.
When he reacted by drawing back, Maria fled. She reported the attack to the police and gave the description of the man that had attacked her. She told police that, quote, it was a man with dark hair, horn-rimmed glasses, who was dressed like the priest. She couldn't say if he was a priest or not, but she said, quote, he seemed to be a priest.
Oh my goodness.
John was placed in a lineup, and Maria picked him out as her attacker. Being at the center of 2 investigations, John was polygraphed by the premier lie detector firm in the county, which concluded that he was not telling the truth. While we know now that this is far from being reliable, it was very suspicious that John was thought to have been purposely trying to control his breathing during the test and made the very bizarre comment that, quote, there won't be any more evidence that comes out, and what you have isn't enough to convict me.
What? That is bold to say.
It is a super bizarre thing to say when you're being questioned about attacking a woman.
Right, because if you are a priest and you are innocent, You're going to say things like, I hope you find more evidence. I hope you find who actually did this. You should be coming at this with a loving, understanding heart.
Yes. Not, oh, there isn't enough to convict me. And kind of being cocky and throwing it in their face.
Yeah.
It was almost as if John felt he had some higher power in his corner.
He doesn't believe God's telling him to do this, does he?
No.
He thinks he is God?
No, he didn't think he was God. But he did feel like he had some higher powers that were backing him up. And that's exactly what he did have. While it was clear to those investigating the case that John was the dirtbag, a very shady backdoor handshake between the ranking Catholic sheriff and church officials would allow him to go free.
What?
In letters sent between August 1st and October of 1960 between church officials, there were concerns expressed about the ramifications if a priest was charged with Irene's death. According to the letters, the implications would be huge. The re-election chances of the local Catholic sheriff would be at stake, not to mention what could happen to the Catholic John Kennedy's presidential campaign that was all gearing up at the same time.
He's going to get off for political reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's infuriating.
Yeah.
So they didn't know that he was going to be doing this, but they're letting him go basically to protect.
Right. They don't want it to look bad on the church.
And John knew that that's the stance they were going to take?
Yes. Because this wasn't the first time he had gotten in trouble. The Reverend Joseph Pedlitsky, a pastor at the church outside of Austin, wrote to the Reverend Lawrence Saddell, the head of the Oblates of Mary Immaculate Order, to which John belonged, insisting he hire a private investigator to find, quote, loopholes in John's case. One letter suggested that a meeting be held to make sure that the sheriff at the time, E.E. Vickers, be made aware, along with the prosecution team, about just how strong the opposition to any charges being brought against Father Fite would be, and that, quote, the church would not take this sitting down.
Oh my goodness! Church, what do you stand for?
The letter continued, quote, the prosecution must be made to see just how weak their case is, lest they go off half-cocked and set the wheels into motion that would bring this out into public print and give the opponents of the church a field day.
No way. I think church needs to go back to its Bible and read about how rape and sexual assault is a sin and how murder is a sin.
And how covering up murder is a sin.
Yes. The audacity.
Yes.
That is so terrible. And what an abuse of power.
The letter also alluded to advice received from the sheriff to have the, quote, young man transferred to another part of the county as a normal obedience. He feels that everyone knows that the priests are always being transferred around, so this would not be strange. After some time in his new place, a year or two, then have him sent out on a foreign mission. The reason for the first move is to get him out of the area of suspicion. If something happens, the officers of this area will always be suspicious of him. The sheriff concludes that the longer time we have, the weaker the case gets. He has much experience in such things, and I believe this is extremely wise. He is also Catholic, and he also stands to lose materially by such a scandal here, in such a non-Catholic area.
Oh, very non-Catholic of you, sir. And what does he mean he has experience with this?
Well, because he's a sheriff. So he knows the way that the police work and how the case will turn out if it goes cold.
Okay. Not that he's done similar things.
No, I don't think that that's what they were alluding to.
Okay.
But that he had some experience in how to navigate the case.
Wow. And I just can't even believe that they're willing to just put him somewhere else so he can continue to offend. Hmm? That doesn't fix the problem. That just fixes your problem.
Mm-hmm. Deep digging by investigators would reveal these correspondence a half a century later.
Oh.
And they would be the catalyst that would resurrect the truth to catch this dirtbag. Irene's family had long suspected that there had been a conspiracy between the authorities and the church to protect John, but they couldn't prove it at the time. It would also be learned that it wasn't the first handshake deal that would take care of John's behavior.
No.
It seems like a deal had also been struck to bring John to the church in McAllen from the neighboring town after the attack on Maria.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. They just put him in another town and then he escalates to murder and you want to just put him to a different town.
Yes.
They all should be charged and thrown in the slammer. They are all responsible, in my eyes, for Irene's death.
Yes.
They all played a part.
Because they just tried to cover up his despicable behavior.
Yeah. They can all go you know where in a handbasket.
The first deal hadn't been done quickly enough, though, to hide the truth of Maria's attack. Police had found out about it, and they had brought John in for a lineup for Maria to identify, trying to establish his character as their suspect. A single newspaper had gotten hold of this story and made headline news of it. And so they couldn't erase or cover up the attack on Maria.
But don't they think people are going to connect the dots?
They don't. They stopped it at one newspaper getting a hold of it.
Oh, because I'm sure they got strong-armed into not running anything else.
Well, I can't imagine any other newspapers at the time not picking up the story of a priest attacking a young woman.
Yes.
But only one ever did. But it didn't necessarily mean that John would be held accountable for his attack, even though that one newspaper had gotten a hold of that story. On August 6th, a warrant was issued for John's arrest in connection to Maria's attack. It would take over a week to bring him in because John had been conveniently moved to Alexian Brothers Hospital and Dispensary for what he called a nervous condition brought on by the stress of the legal trouble he was in.
Oh, poor John.
Yeah. He spent 2 weeks there, and when questioned, he told police that he had developed a fear of women. Apparently, this admission was enough to remain in treatment and free until his trial the following year.
No way.
Mm-hmm. In 1961, when he stood trial for the rape of Maria, he and his very well-paid lawyer played up the nervous issue, and the jury actually deadlocked over it.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
But if he's acting like the celibate priest who's afraid of women, how could he possibly do something like this?
That's right. And so the jury couldn't decide if he was guilty or not.
Well, I think subconsciously we don't want to believe that a priest can do this or an officer can be dirty like that.
Exactly. It just goes against what we naturally assume.
Because it rocks our safety then.
Mm-hmm. When facing the possibility of a second trial, a deal was worked out quietly that John would plead guilty to aggravated assault, which we know is not even equivalent to rape, and he would face no jail time. Instead, he had to pay a $500 fine, which is equivalent to $5,000 today. A promise was made by acting church officials at the time to discipline John in their own way and send him to a monastery. The investigation into Irene's death wasn't pursued anymore after that. Deputy sheriffs were told that their superiors would handle the case from then on. According to one journalist at the time, Daryl Davis, the case was made to grow cold. He said that a few select journalists were called into an off-the-record meeting, and he said that they were told verbatim, quote, "We know that Father Fite killed Irene, and the church knows that he killed Irene Garza. So we have made some arrangements. The church is going to put him in a monastery, and he will be kept there for the rest of his life." Terry McKernan, a founder of Bishop's Accountability, said that, quote, "When priests get into trouble, then the moving begins. Some people call it the geographical solution. It was for many years the standard way for abuse allegations to be handled."
No way. I didn't even think of something like this.
Yeah.
It makes you a little more suspicious if you see a new priest moving into your neighborhood.
Exactly. Geographical solution? It's covering up a murder.
Yeah. And just spreading that violence around.
Mm-hmm. In early February of 1962, 5 months after Maria's trial and less than 2 years after Irene's murder, John was dispatched to Iowa and the new Melleray Abbey, a monastery for monks. Because there was little access to the outside world and not a lot of talking that goes on in a monastery, the others that were with John had no knowledge of his past.
And did they send him there so there wouldn't be women around him?
It wasn't because there weren't women around. It sounded like it was just the farthest away they could get him.
And then these poor monks have no idea that they're living with a murderer.
Nope. That abbey actually had a school attached to it.
A school?
Mm-hmm. Which then resulted at the beginning of 1963 with Father Fite getting moved again, this time to another tapestry monastery, the Assumption Abbey in Ava, Missouri. Interestingly, Assumption Abbey didn't have a school attached.
So there's a good chance that he abused a child.
It would be just an assumption. There's no records of it. But I do find it very interesting that he changed positions so quickly and they went from one with a school attached to one with no school attached.
So he could have assaulted a child or maybe a teacher. Mm-hmm. Because I'm thinking every time he gets moved, something's happened.
It does sound that way.
Yeah. And this is their way to sweep it under the rug.
Yep. Just move him to a new area so he won't arouse suspicion. It was at Assumption Abbey where John would meet Dale Tacony, a priest that would later testify against John after he had turned in his own cassock. In 1963, Dale was a young monk serving as a novice master at the monastery, training new prospective monks. He was told to counsel John because he, quote, had murdered a young woman. He said he wasn't told any other details by his superiors at the time. During their conversations, John confessed to Dale that he had attacked a young woman following her confession, kept her captive overnight, and then left her to suffocate. He told him the unnamed woman was eventually dumped in a canal. At the time, John never revealed this woman's name. Dale and John's counseling relationship ended 6 months later when John was transferred to Loyola College, a Jesuit school in his hometown of Chicago. So again, he's moving fairly quickly around. Allegedly, John was not fitting in well at the monastery, and it was felt that he wouldn't be a good fit back into a parish because he still expressed urges to attack women.
Oh, what is wrong with these people?
Well, some critics of the faith have said that it is a fairly common practice to send floundering priests back to school. And so that's what they did. John was enrolled as a graduate student in philosophy, but only stayed one semester in the degree program.
And then he got transferred.
He did.
That means he attacked someone else.
There was no indication or any reason given for the transfer, but he was transferred. It was the semester that President John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and things changed in a lot of people's lives that day. So maybe that was monumental to John as well and had something to do with his movement, or maybe someone had rethoughts about his proximity to young college students.
Or he had already attacked one.
Possibly.
Well, this is how they solve any indiscretion. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking every time they've moved him, he's done something.
It does sound highly suspicious of that. Because the final place that he does actually spend some time at is with all men.
Yeah, then it totally is, Melissa. And this tells me that he has no remorse. He has no fear of getting reprimanded or having any kind of consequence to his action. Because he was only there 6 months and they already had to move him. So he gets there and it's just like a new feeding ground. All right, this is exciting. Who do I get to find here?
Right. And it also explains his behavior of why he didn't really feel that when the police even brought him in 2016, he's like, well, this means nothing. I'll be protected.
Oh, massive dirtbag.
Yes. By the end of 1964, John was headed west to New Mexico to a facility run by a Roman Catholic religious order called the Servants of Paraclete, a monastery for troubled priests.
There's a monastery for troubled priests?
Yeah.
I had no idea. Did you before researching?
I didn't. This was an eye-opening case for me.
And this is still going?
It sounded like the monastery was still there. I don't know if it's still the place to send troubled priests or not.
But they still have places to send troubled priests?
Unless all the troubled priests have been cured, I would assume they would still need a place. But this place was described as, quote, a place of last resort for some of the church's most troubled priests. And as a, quote, supermax, because there's really nowhere else to go if you want to stay in the church.
Why didn't they just kick him out?
Takes a lot, I guess. John spent 7 years there and rose to the position of a superior, supervising other priests, sometimes up to 80 at a time.
80?
Mm-hmm.
We have a murdering rapist as
the supervisor
of 80 priests.
Yeah, 80 troubled priests.
Oh my goodness.
One of the priests that he was set to supervise was James Porter from Massachusetts. I'm not sure if you're familiar with his case. But he was the dirtbag that was eventually stripped of his title as a priest and convicted of molesting 28 children. And he actually claimed to molesting over 100.
Oh.
While supervising this dirtbag, John repeatedly gave him assignments that would put him in direct contact with children, knowing what he was capable of.
Oh.
In one letter to his own superior, John wrote about Porter, the child molester, quote, "He is a willing worker and gets along well with pastors and people wherever he goes. Thus far, there has been no occurrence of the problems which plagued Father Porter in the past." Order would eventually be sent out of the monastery into the world to abuse more children with no warning of the danger that he presented by his superior John. So eventually they just let him go into the world and nobody said anything about his past molestations.
And he was able to then go on and molest up to 100 children.
Yes.
Ruined 100 lives.
Mm-hmm.
This is horrible.
In 1971, more than 11 years after Irene's murder, John requested laicization and dispensation from his obligations as a priest. He married a young AT&T worker that he met at the church in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he started a family. By all accounts, after that, he became a model citizen, working at different jobs to support his family. He moved to several cities in the Midwest before settling into the Arcadia District of Phoenix in 1979, where his older brother, Matthias, was living and working as a priest. For more than 20 years, John Feit lived in Arizona, raising his family, and became a grandfather, with no one around him knowing the secrets that he hid. That was until 2002, 42 years after the murder, when the former priest Dale, overwhelmed by his conscience, came forward to police with the information of the confession John had given in 1963.
Wow.
Now, as a tax advisor in Oklahoma City, Dale wrote a letter to the San Antonio police saying he had information about the death of an unnamed woman in the 1960s on Easter weekend. The priest's name was John Feit. The San Antonio police knew nothing about this case, but the Texas Rangers did. It was as if the fates had aligned to bring Irene justice, because just that year, McAllen Police Chief Victor Rodriguez had decided to reopen the investigation into Irene's death.
Wow.
Chief Rodriguez brought in a newly formed cold case unit of Texas Rangers. Ranger Rudy Jaramillo was the leading investigator. Texas Rangers met with Dale, and he told them what John had said about the murder, that he had taken Irene to the rectory for confession, and that he had restrained her and took off her blouse and fondled her breasts, and after that he took her down to the basement, where he assumed that John had restrained the girl because she was made to stay there because the rectory walls were thick. Nobody would be able to hear any sounds of struggles or screams that she made. John, now acting as Father Feit, went back up to the church to hear more confessions.
Oh.
After everyone left that Holy Saturday, he moved Irene a few miles away to the pastoral house. The next day, Easter Sunday, he put her in the bathroom, put her in the tub, and he said he put a bag or something over her head. When he was leaving to go back and say vigil mass, John told Dale he heard her say, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe." John had told him when he came back, he opened the bathroom door and she was dead. He used his car to take her body out along the canal and dumped her there.
What did he think was going to happen when he tied a bag around her head?
And she's telling him, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe."
Yeah, he was trying to kill her.
Mm-hmm. But I think in his confession to Dale, I think he was trying to make it sound like, oh, more it was an accident.
There's no redeeming what you just did, sir.
No.
And to me, it just shows how evil he is, that he can literally come up from raping and taking advantage of a woman and then participate in religious acts.
Mm-hmm.
Just moments later.
Yeah. He has no conscience at all.
No.
The investigators tracked down the original priest that had noticed scratch marks on his hands, Father O'Brien, and he also said that John had told him a very similar confession. There were some discrepancies between the two versions, though. Father O'Brien, at the time, was suffering from dementia, so his recollection was called into question, and Dale had assumed that the murder had taken place in San Antonio, where John had gone to school, and that the murder occurred in the same year that John had come to the monastery in 1963. So when they're both giving their versions, there's a few discrepancies. And this could have been why that in 2004, the indictment failed.
Oh, but they also have to take into consideration this has been decades ago.
Mm-hmm. But the jury ruled that at the time, there wasn't enough evidence to put John on trial.
Just two priests saying, yeah, he confessed.
Mm-hmm. The district prosecutor at the time was so confident that John's case was so untriable that he told one of Renee's family members that she would never get an indictment on the case. He said, quote, "not until pigs fly."
Wow.
That's the district prosecutor, the one that's supposed to be
doing everything in his power to get a conviction.
Yeah, he's supposed to be championing, trying to find justice for the victims' families.
Not until pigs fly.
Yeah. Over the next 12 years, the cold case investigators would not give up. There were just too many details that fit John's attack of Irene not to be true from the two priest confessions. The show 48 Hours did a segment on John Fite in 2014 and cast a lot of suspicion on him. So when a new district attorney was appointed, they vowed to get justice for Irene. Investigators kept looking for witnesses to establish John's pattern of behavior. Anna Maria Hollingsworth would later testify that Father John had lured Irene into the rectory prior to that fateful Easter when he took her life. Irene had confided in her friend, Anna, that the priest had pulled her out of confessional to confess face to face in the previous weeks. She had told her friend, quote, "It's not the same going to confession anymore. I don't get to stay in the confessional." Referring to John, the young priest, she had told her friend that he thinks he's handsome and, quote, "He comes to pull me out and says, oh, this place isn't good enough for you. Let's go to the rectory where you'll be more comfortable." And then we would walk off and go to the rectory. Anna said Irene had been confused about having to go to the rectory, but had gone along. Because who's expecting the priest to make sexual advances, let alone be a predator? The perfect wolf in sheep's clothing.
Oh, yeah.
Or in priest clothing. In reality, John was probably practicing his timeline and seeing if he could get Irene to go along with him. Working the cold case, two other women were found that had experiences with John while he was supposedly serving at the Sacred Heart Church. Instead of serving there, he was using it to lure in his prey. Beatrice Garcia was walking alone one day and was approached by Father John in a car, 3 weeks prior to Irene's disappearance. It would have been right after he had been moved the short distance to McAllen to escape his previous behavior with Maria at the church in Edinburgh. During that interaction, John had said, quote, "I would love to take a picture of you dressed in black by the cemetery." She thought he was trying to scare her, and he had succeeded, so she had fled, luckily.
What a creepy thing to say.
Mm-hmm. In another incident, Tilly Sanchez, who was the cook at the church rectory at the time, said that she overheard John commenting to the other priest as she went for supplies in the cellar, quote, "How about we close the door and make Tilly disappear?" Later, she received a call at the rectory and was sure it was Father John at the other end that said, quote, "Tilly, you're next, honey."
You're kidding me. Everyone just knew about this and was okay with letting it happen.
Yeah. Tilly had notified the McAllen police and told them about the priest's threat, but it was all somehow swept under the rug. And Tilly was told by church officials that she was mistaken.
So they're gaslighting her.
Mm-hmm. When looking at photos of these young women, it should have been very clear that John had a particular type of woman that he sought out. And there was a clear pattern of escalation that led to Irene's assault and death. When John was finally brought to trial in 2017, he still proclaimed his innocence, despite the evidence against him. During the 7-day trial in Edinburgh, the prosecution outlined the connections between John and Irene's death, his past pattern of behavior, and claimed there was a cover-up conspiracy that had kept a known murderer a secret for 57 years and resulted in one of the oldest cases in the U.S. being brought to trial. The defense tried to argue that there was no evidence to connect John to the crime and that there was never a conspiracy to cover up the murder. That if a conspiracy existed, it was that Dale's version of John's confession had been coached by investigators. The defense also tried to cast suspicion on another priest that was at the Sacred Heart Church at that time, Father Richard Yonish. He was never suspected by the police at the time and had since passed away, so couldn't defend himself. But it was all because the defense were so desperate, because they knew their client was a dirtbag. On December 8, 2017, John Bernard Fite was sentenced to life in prison with eligibility of parole in just 7 years.
What?
Yeah. The jury had deliberated 4 hours over his sentence. 57 years after her death, Irene's remaining family members celebrated, and the prosecutor, Mike Garza, not a relative but definitely an advocate for Irene, said the result was perfect. Everyone won except John. John was sent to the Department of Criminal Justice in Huntsville, Texas, and then later to the hospital facility in Galveston because of his failing health. That is where he died on February 14, 2020, alone in his cell. He was buried at St. Francis Catholic Cemetery in Phoenix, Arizona. And that is the case of the wolf in priest's clothing, the lying dirtbag predator, John Bernard Fite, the man who thought he had escaped punishment for the murder of the beautiful Irene Garza, the one who thought he had higher powers protecting him.
The one who did have higher powers protecting him.
Yeah.
Were there any charges laid to any of these people that were involved in the cover-ups?
No, none.
That's an injustice.
It is. I think it would have been fitting for there to be charges laid to just set a precedence.
Absolutely.
That this is not okay.
Because these people who covered for him have a hand in all the future victims after that.
Mm-hmm. A lot of them had passed away by this time because it took 57 years to bring about justice.
That's true. I don't know how they slept at night.
No. But in the end, the truth was resurrected.
I'm glad that it was, but I'm sad that he got 57 years to live his life. And I don't know if I believe that he stopped assaulting. I don't think you can be a serial assaulter like that and then just stop because you got married and had a family.
It is very curious. And I think the same as you, that the amount of times that he was moved very quickly around after the assaults indicates that he probably hadn't stopped assaulting then either.
No, the only one you said he stayed a long time at was one that was just male.
Mm-hmm.
That is so telling.
It is. But there are no reports of him having any other assaults after that. Everyone that knew him as a family man believed him to be this model, charitable person, this former priest that was so kind and loving.
And there was no reports of him being abusive to his wife or children. No sexual allegations there.
There was none that came out. His family did not stand by him, though.
Okay.
They did not come to his trial at all.
That's just sad all around and infuriating.
It was. But I am so grateful for those investigators, those cold case investigators that did not give up and finally brought some justice. It was sad to hear about Irene's parents. They had passed away, and so they never learned what had happened to their daughter. But they always had a suspicion that it had been a cover-up. And it wasn't until years later that people actually started coming out and saying, yes, there was something going on. There was a cover-up.
And when there's a cover-up that high up, you would just feel even that much more helpless.
It would just make you that much more of a victim.
Right, because you can't turn to your clergy, and you can't turn to the authorities.
No. It was both of them covering it up.
Yeah. So your hands are completely tied. Oh, you would just feel sickened.
All because of the actions of one dirtbag.
Well, actually, the actions of many.
Oh, it's true. And there never seems to be a shortage of those.
There definitely isn't. I'm going to bring you a dirtbag next week that really got under my skin. So prepare yourself.
Until then.
See ya.
Bye.
I'm like, hey, listeners. Hang on, I feel like my throat's being funny.
Hi, listeners.
Another Texas?
Yes, I am picking
so
on Texas.
Many Texas.
I know. I don't know why. I tried to purposely not pick ones from Texas, but I always find my way there. This one, actually, when I first started reading about him, he was in Arizona. And I was like, oh, I don't think we covered an Arizona one. The murder was from Texas.
That's why, Melissa.
Because just give me a second. I got to think, Christy. And I'm not going to call him father because I just don't want to.
No.
He's a dirtbag, John. Oh, dang it. Stop hitting things, people.
I was sitting here quietly, but I'm still sorry. I got the mom voice. He thinks he is God?
Nope.
Oh.
These are real people that are in his corner.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, rein it in, Christy.
Your
I was like, oh, that doesn't sound right.
It's etched in my brain. I wish I had a camera. Oh, my goodness. It didn't even, clue into me until then, once you realized what you said and then your face. Oh.
I'm going to take a drink while you laugh at me, okay?
No, these were real. Okay, so you need to re-say that.
What? I think that all just flows perfectly.
Yeah.
Hey, we're live, pal, and we'd love for you to come check out our podcast, Tales from the Estate. Each week, we talk about our top five favorite somethings. My beautiful wife, Caitlin, likes to share all sorts of random facts.
Yeah. Did you know that cows have accents?
We did now. But we also review all sorts of snacks and other great things. And so if you love everything random, I think you'd enjoy Tales from the Estate. So come check us out.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
I'm Matt Kundle, host of the Sound Off Podcast, the show about podcast and broadcast. Since 2016, we've been speaking with amazing people who have populated your ears for decades. Legendary broadcasters, research wizards, talent experts, podcasters, voice talent. Almost 400 stories, all for free. Subscribe or follow the Sound Off Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or at soundoffpodcast.com.
Another Sound Off Media Company podcast.